Ladies and gentlemen, if I can just interrupt you, because we're going to begin. It's very, very encouraging to see such a large turnout in the middle of July, and it's a testament both to our speaker, Mike McConville, and to the subject. I have to say that we have, in the past, spoken about legal issues on the mainland, and one is always hesitant, particularly as a journalist, to talk about a groundbreaking book, because someone will come up and say, well, you know, that was done 10 years ago. But the simple fact of the matter is, this is a groundbreaking book in examining the Chinese judiciary from the ground upwards, looking at it in terms of, you know, not whether it's morally right or wrong, but asking the crucial questions of how does it work and what actually happens in practice. Mike McConville has been working on this for a very long time, and he has not only experience in Chinese law, he was he's the Dean of the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University, but he's also undertaken work in countries as diverse as Latvia, Turkey, Malawi, and Peru. I'm going to limit all the questions on Latvia, incidentally. But with that proviso, let me welcome Mike McConville.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk today. I'm going to talk about a research project which has taken more than 10 years to complete, and which involves the collection of original data from within mainland China. I can go into more detail of that in questions, so I'll just say that much. It would be inappropriate to evaluate Chinese judges in criminal cases against an idealized model, or fail to acknowledge that there may be many problems with the judges in other legal systems. Our impressions are often anecdotal, and they come from individual cases or individual indiscretions. The image of China, which predates the modern reform era, is well documented. Police, procurators, and judges formed an iron triangle, three workshops in the same factory. Chinese criminal courts were constructed to administer the last rites over cases, the outcomes of which were predetermined. Verdict first, trial later. Judges needed little expertise. They could be drawn from former military personnel, factory workers, and other cadres. At trial, there were no witnesses. Judges presided over the court, questioned the defendant, presented the prosecution case, decided verdict, and pronounced sentence. A second image has been developed arising out of the reforms brought in by the 1996 criminal procedure law. The parties, prosecution and defense, were to be responsible for presenting the case. Witnesses were to be produced for examination and cross-examination, and judges were to become neutral arbiters. This was heralded as the first step towards an adversary system of justice well known in the common law world. So in this talk, I want to examine briefly what has happened to this proto-adversarial system and the role of judges within it. I will do this through the lens of a single miscarriage of justice case, the skeleton facts of which are in the public domain already. This will form the setting for comparison against the empirical data which I had collected with my team of colleagues over a long period of time, beginning in discussions began in 1994, and the research was concluded in 2006 with some follow-up visits between then and now. The research was based in 13 different court areas throughout China, developed and less developed regions. It involved the examination of 1,144 prosecution case files which had not been tampered with. The observation of 227 trials involving 335 defendants, and interviews with 88 judges, 96 prosecutors, and 83 defense lawyers. The case is a simple one. In 1999, Zhao Zhujiang, a poor farmer from a village in Henan province, confessed to killing a fellow villager. Zhao was released 11 years later in 2010, not for a murder that he had not committed, but for a murder which had not taken place at all, the alleged victim having reappeared at the village 10 years later. So the first aspect of this case was that Zhao had confessed during his detention by the police. Securing a confession is a major focus of the police, even though their responsibility under the law is to investigate crime and to produce evidence and collect and obtain evidence to prove the criminal suspect guilty or innocent. In fact, our research shows that no efforts have been made on the part of the police and the prosecution to identify evidence which is consistent with the suspect's guilt and also with the suspect's innocence, but only with the suspect's guilt. There is no case we could find which produced in any sense a balanced dossier. So a great deal of the effort of the police is going to be expended in questioning the suspect. Well, was Zhao's confession typical or untypical? We found in the cases we looked at, more than 1,000 of those cases throughout the country, in more than 95% of cases, there was a confession made by the defendant. Typically, suspects are subject to multiple interviews, and there are typically a number of so-called confession statements which form part of the prosecution case. In some cases, those statements may number 8, 9, 10, or 11. Why are the police so keen to secure a confession? While the formal law prohibits the extortion of confessions, for the police there is a strong temptation because there is no exclusionary rule in China under which a confession illegally obtained cannot be relied upon by the court. In fact, there is nothing to prevent the court from relying upon confessions, however obtained. Confessions in China are described always as the king of evidence. So if the police are so efficient, what are the mechanisms which they use in order to get such a high rate of confessions? The Special Rapporteur for the United Nations Commission on Human Rights concluded, despite significant attempts to obstruct his investigations and operating under what he called a palpable level of fear and self-censorship, torture remained a favored resource for interrogators, including the use of electric shock batons, hooding, cigarette burns, submersion pits, and exposure to extreme heat or cold. A Chinese researcher found in 2004 that the police used clubs, leather belts, electric wire, and so-called water cure, in which interrogators pour water into the mouth of suspects to induce a sensation of drowning. Typically, where torture is used, regimes develop their own argot. In China, torture techniques are variously described as using the tiger stool, taking a jet plane, circling the pig, and putting them on the meter. Often, torture is carried out not in the police station, but in black jails or black hostels, which are solely in the control of the police. Practices no doubt vary, and there is evidence that the police in some areas are utilizing so-called soft torture, such as putting people into stress positions for long hours or depriving them of sleep and so forth, which leaves no physical trace. And the reason for that is that torture cases are not reported in China unless they lead to serious injury or death. What could that mean in an individual case? In the case of Zhao, he confessed after 33 days in detention, during which he had been tortured by five police officers. He was handcuffed to a chair, beaten with sticks, threatened with being shot, had firecrackers exploded around his head, was forced to sit on a beer bottle, was forced to ingest drugs, and denied food and sleep for long periods of time. Even if a confession has been extracted by torture, allegations of torture at trial would be unlikely because of the principle in sentencing of leniency to those who confess. But allegations do surface, and in our research, in our observation of trials, a number of defendants claimed that their confessions had been extorted by torture. We found that allegations by defendants, or occasionally by their lawyers, were not pursued at all, were brushed aside, and where defendants claimed to have residual scars from torture, these were simply disregarded. Or the defense were asked instead to provide proof of torture. Or the court simply said, there is other evidence which is consistent with the confession. In no case did any judge express or exhibit concern of any kind over allegations of torture, and in no case was an inquiry of any kind undertaken to establish what had occurred at the police station or in detention or in one of the hotels controlled by the police. A second aspect of the Zhao case was that he had been in pre-trial detention for 3 years. Part of the delay is accounted for by the fact that prosecutors, concerned about the sufficiency of evidence in the case, requested the police to undertake supplementary investigation. Those requests were disregarded. Well, is lengthy pre-trial detention usual or unusual? We found that the police regularly take advantage of the legal powers which they have to detain people for 30 or 37 days. We found that in 20% of cases, the police took up to 12 months to apply for authorization of arrest, and in a handful of cases, that delay extended to 2 years and beyond. Suspects being held at detention houses or in the black hostels that I'd referred to. Well, the prosecutors were concerned about sufficiency of evidence and they asked for supplementary investigation. Is that common? The answer is that it is not uncommon for prosecutors to request supplementary investigation, but we found that the police simply take no action in regard to such requests. Requests can be made on a second occasion, and again, that simply is evidence that the police have not responded to the first request and will not respond to the second. A third aspect of this case is that there was no forensic evidence of any probative value relating to the death of the torso which was found without a head. The initiating actions of the police had been triggered by the discovery of a beheaded body, but there was no proof as to how the victim had died. An identity was simply and erroneously assumed. Is this usual or typical? Well, scientific or forensic evidence is not a significant feature of investigation in China, except, of course, in cases such as involving drugs or to establish the nature of a wound on the body. In many areas, of course, the police have limited equipment and they do not have advanced scientific means in order to investigate. But more generally, a confession is seen as disposing of the need for thorough investigative investigation by forensic mechanisms. A fourth aspect is the trial itself. Zhao's trial was concluded in about 30 minutes. The court in China generally consists of a panel of judges or judges and lay assessors, three in number. Actually, only one of those is actively involved in the case responsible judge. The other two are simply making up the numbers. Commonly, they're engaged in unrelated activities, such as working on their own case files, answering telephones, leaving the courtroom for periods of time during the course of the trial, occasionally smoking or falling asleep. Many of the defendants, a disproportionate number, are migrants. In our study, 55% of those charged were migrants. When questions were put to them, they often look round in puzzlement as to what was happening. Almost all defendants were produced from detention, often in slippers, with shaved heads, wearing a bright orange or red vest marked detention house, restricted by handcuffs, and in some instances, shackles. These trials are rapid affairs. We found that 1/3 of the most serious cases were completed in less than 1 hour, and 80% were completed in less than 2 hours. So how does this happen? First, the prosecution never produce a witness. Very occasionally, a victim might be in court, but that will be because the victim will be pursuing a separate and parallel suit for compensation. Whilst one part of the law provides that the testimony of a witness may be used as a basis for deciding a case only after the witness has been questioned and cross-examined in the courtroom by both sides, another part of the code says that the records of witnesses who are not present in court and the conclusion of expert witnesses who are not present in court may be read out instead. What happens is the prosecutor will either read out those statements or more usually will read out a précis or extracts from those statements. But no witnesses will be produced. There are no witnesses for the defense. Requests by defense lawyers to call witnesses were occasionally made, but they were in all cases dismissed by the judge. The third feature is that the judge does not assume the neutral arbiter role which was contemplated in 1996. Instead, the judges openly ally themselves with the prosecution, admonishing defendants to speak louder or to not speak at all, stopping defense lawyers in their tracks, and making good the deficiencies of the prosecution case by ensuring the prosecutor has not overlooked an important point. Let me just give you two short quotations from judges. "We are biased towards the prosecutor, so we seldom stop them talking. But we do stop lawyers' speeches more often. The defender's speech is too long and they cannot focus on the key points in their defense. And in this situation, I will not allow the lawyer to speak." Second judge: "As a judge, my main responsibility is to control the pace of adjudication, use the law to convict the defendant, let the evidence speak for itself, remedy the mistakes of the prosecutor and criticize wrong viewpoints advanced by defenders. Judges accordingly approach the trial with a predisposition to convict. They are, in fact, many times involved in cases before trial. They may even see victims and witnesses. They liaise closely with prosecutors, and they identify with the objectives of the police. They may also collect evidence undisclosed to the defense prior to trial and indeed after the trial itself when there is an adjournment. The trial, therefore, though a procedural requirement, has little substantive link to the outcome of the case. The next aspect of Zhao's case is the defense. The defense, very often, is wholly ineffective. And why? Well, first of all, about 25% of defendants are not represented. This does not merely apply to cases which might be regarded as not at the serious end of the crime continuum, snatching handbags or mobile phones, but it also applied to more serious cases, such as robbery, in some of which the victim had died, intentional injury causing death, drugs trafficking, kidnapping, and so forth. Second aspect is that where a lawyer is engaged and is engaged early in the case, the lawyer will be routinely denied access to the client in custody. Many, of course, are engaged late in the day, having been contacted recently by the defendant's family. Indeed, in one of the trials that we observed, the defendant, on being told the identity of the judges and advised of his right to object to any member of the court, pointed to one individual, but withdrew his objection when he was informed that the person in question was in fact his lawyer. Third, the lawyers are poorly prepared. We found that defense lawyers were, in general, ill-prepared for trial, having engaged in minimal preparation, which generally went no further than a short conversation with the defendant and a quick scan of the documents disclosed to them by the prosecution. A background reason for this is Article 306 of the criminal law. Any lawyer who proposes to become proactively engaged with the defense, as by interviewing potential witnesses, is confronted by Article 306, by virtue of which they may be exposed to prosecution for malicious libel if they adduce evidence which contradicts that already secured by the police or prosecutor from the defendant or any witness. They may be found to have enticed the witness to change the testimony or to give false testimony. And a number of lawyers have in fact been charged and prosecuted under this provision. Clearly, this has a chilling effect upon all lawyers, and the impact of it cannot be overstressed. Many lawyers will not now undertake criminal defense work, which increases the number of unrepresented defendants, results in non-active representation where there is a lawyer, and leads to a reduction in available expertise as good lawyers simply cease taking criminal cases. In addition to that, as has been widely reported, lawyers have now become a target. Defense lawyers have increasingly joined the ranks of the disappeared. When they emerge, they are effectively under house arrest, and in a sinister current development, their treatment under detention has caused them never to speak about what has happened to them and to stop taking criminal cases. In this way, without a free press, a cordon sanitaire is being thrown around the criminal justice system. finally, so I can keep space for questions, when the court adjourns at the end of this short trial, must not be imagined that the judge then goes out to form a verdict. What happens is the judge has to consult with either the adjudicative committee or the political legal committee. The principal committee is the political legal committee, which is chaired by the local chief of police. The influence of that is direct. They simply tell the judge what the outcome will be and tell the judge what the sentence will be. And Zhao's case is a perfect demonstration of that. 3 years in detention prior to the trial. The prosecutors were hanging out because they were concerned about the sufficiency of evidence. Why was he prosecuted? The answer is that the political legal committee directed that a prosecution be undertaken. So that committee can both initiate the prosecution and, drawing full circle, ensure its successful conclusion after trial. I'll go into more detail on any matters through questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That was rather chilling, to be honest with you. I don't know if anybody from the Canadian government was listening to all of that. It's the usual procedure. If you wish to ask a question, can you identify yourself and wait for the mics? We have one question down here from Joel Aiken.
Just a quick one. I'm Joel Lakin, I'm speaking on behalf of the IPPF. There's such a thing in China as the enforcement tribunal, which I'm given to understand sometimes has the power to set aside legitimate judgments. Does it still exist, and could you comment on the enforcement tribunal as to what it actually does?
This is not a relevant matter for criminal cases, and the research that I'm talking about is entirely confined to criminal cases.
Can I just ask you a question, which is, right at the end, you talked about the role of the party in these matters. Is that the only formal link between the party and the judiciary? I mean, for example, to what extent is the party involved in appointment of judges, this sort of thing?
All judges serve at the behest of the party. The local party is responsible for the appointment of judges, and for the local area is responsible for their remuneration. And so judges don't hold their position as a tenured position. They're always vulnerable to removal. But many of these judges are not judges as we might imagine. In our study, for example, a majority of judges had worked their way up, having begun as court clerks. Many of them have served only sessions at night school or in the party school, and their degrees or diplomas have been obtained either by distance learning or through the party. So these are, in criminal cases, these judges are imperfectly educated, and they are rewarded in remuneration terms at very low wages. They are themselves vulnerable to an audit system under which they must account for their decisions. So, for example, were they to produce a number of acquittals which went beyond what is accepted, they would be open to discipline and punishment. And all of the systems, the police system,
the prosecutor system has to comply with an audit system so far as, for example, the number or the proportion of cases where bail can be given, the number of requests for approval or arrest which can be refused. All of these are subject to a quota in each region, and if that quota is exceeded, then discipline and punishment will follow. And that might simply be loss of bonus for the individual or loss of bonus for the unit in question. So the whole system is one of discipline and punishment under a strict regime of auditing.
Okay, one question back.
Thank you, Tom Hollander, South China Morning Post. Professor McConville, you mentioned the low pay of judges. Presumably that opens up the possibility for corruption. Is corruption a significant factor in criminal law, or is that more on the commercial side? And how open is the system to buying verdicts?
I think we begin with the proposition that there are more opportunities on the commercial side, simply because the availability of resources and finance is much more ready. In criminal cases, however, which involves things such as drugs trafficking, money laundering, and so forth, there are significant opportunities available there. We found it a difficult task to talk to judges directly about corruption, and most of the information judges gave us on all of these matters came without prompting from us. But they did raise the question of corruption regularly and talked about having to avoid simple matters such as going for dinner, for lunch with lawyers, with those related to victims. Corruption was something which was in the air all the time, but the opportunities for corruption in criminal cases are far reduced.
Ching Chong down here, who might well have some unique insights into this.
Professor McConville, I'm Ching Chong from the Strict Times. I congratulate you for putting out such a masterpiece. Every bit of the information you list in your book, I can confirm your observation with my own very nasty experience. So my question is, the problems that you observed took place in a period when China is supposed to be reforming its legal system with the passage of this legal procedure law. But in recent years, we see a very obvious retrogression of this process. There's in fact a reversion back to the old days when the people's courts rely on political verdicts rather than legal evidence to convict a person. So, what is your feeling for the criminal investigation process in China in the near future? We also know that recently they are going to revise another time this criminal procedure law. Do you see any evidence for optimism? Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're right that when I first started to think about doing this research, began in 1994 when I was invited to go to Beijing to advise on the criminal procedure law as it was then in draft stage. And that was a time of optimism, probably exaggerated optimism from somebody coming from Ireland. But the Irish, as you know, are always optimistic. And it was the driving force behind the study. And although I would not have been able to secure formal permission from Beijing to undertake the study, I was able over a period of years to generate enough enthusiasm from reformers in China to make it possible to get access to this material, which, as you know, is forbidden even to people from mainland China. So this was an era of optimism, and one of the expectations arising out of the study was that not that things would change overnight, but that I would be able to track which aspects of the reform were working and which were not working, and which might, with further reform, improve the situation. And of course, you're right, the period directly covered by the fieldwork through to 2006 was the optimum period for achieving the objectives of this reform. And it's an enormous disappointment, therefore, to say that it's been a huge failure. And if what we found wasn't bad enough, you're right that since, I think we can trace it to 2008, things have got markedly worse. Whilst the three supremes might be an object of amusement to some people, the fact that it has meaning for the party, that even the armed forces are required to retake their oaths of loyalty. First, loyalty is to the party, then to the people, and third comes the constitution and the law. And the whole drive, the driving force now, is away from exposure of these cases in public to a much more, what I would say is a compelled adjudication, Mao Xi-style justice, which is taking place off the radar, under the radar. And I think that that is coupled with the suppression of lawyers, with the moves against activists of any kind, to send the clearest possible message that the era for reform through law is over, and that is ushering in a different age. And therefore, although at the end of this year or the beginning of next year, we are promised further reform of these legal provisions, I do not see that changing the law will lead to predictable changes in the behavior of the courts, who are already set in particular ways.
I'm going with, I hope with your permission, just to squeeze two more questions in, although we're a bit under time. So George Russell, who I can't see, but I know wanted to ask a question. Oh, he's there, he's there.
Hello, George Russell from China Business Law Journal. In the course of your research, did you find any cases that were criminal cases that maybe in other jurisdictions might have been civil cases, such as disputes over property or company ownership or something that outside of China might be considered a non-criminal case that was criminalized in China and subject to the processes that you describe?
Yes, there were. I should explain what we did was to take, in order to ensure the probity of the evidence, what we did in each of the jurisdictions was to take the last at least 50 cases which had been decided by the court and therefore which were effectively sealed files and would not be filtered. And therefore, this is not a true representative sample, but it is everyday cases. And a number of those cases were, in fact, categorized by defendants as being civil disputes, which have been criminalized. Excuse me. But without legal resources, good lawyers to argue the case, this is simply a forlorn plea that was made by the defendants that in fact they have been wrongly categorized and brought into the criminal process. I can't tell you the numbers of those, but they would certainly be 5 or 10 at least such cases.
Thank you, sir. I'm Leon Hill, a counsel to Lakin Communications and a former criminal prosecutor from Southern California. I was wondering, what is the conviction rate during the period of time of your study?
Absolute. On that happy note, I want to thank our speaker very much indeed. I'm sorry. But before you go, we have a traditional gift from the FCC. This is a legal proof external covering. You can wear it in any Chinese court.